Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with America's longest war getting longer following the president's announcement that close to 10,000 U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan longer than previously planned since recent Taliban offensives in Kunduz and across the country have exposed the many weaknesses of the Afghan army and police. The Obama administration's former senior advisor to the special representative for Pakistan and Afghanistan, Vali Nasser, who is now the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, joins us to discuss when and if the Afghan army will be able to defend the country and whether Pakistan is still acting as a spoiler destabilizing Afghanistan. Then we'll go to Israel to speak with the former speaker of the Knesset, Avraham Berg, about the lack of political leadership on both the Palestinian and Israeli sides as events appear to be spiraling out of control in Jerusalem, with many analysts warning that a third intifada is about to erupt. While Prime Minister Netanyahu's right-wing coalition continues to expand settlements but will not state what their endgame with the Palestinians is, we will discuss why successive Israeli governments have been unable to reach a deal with the Palestinians, who remain divided and, despite their suffering, appear unwilling to compromise. Then finally, we will look into what arrangements Israel might have made with Russia in a recent meeting in Moscow between Putin and Netanyahu that preceded Russia's deployment of warplanes and troops in Syria, which left the impression that Russia was more concerned about crossing a red line with Israel than it was with confronting the United States. Asher Kaufman, a professor of peace studies at the University of Notre Dame and the author of Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region, joins us to discuss Israel's possible strategy in Syria and its lack of strategy with the Palestinians as a third intifada brews. And joining us now is Vali Nasser, who is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class, and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
And the president today extended the deployment of U.S. troops in Afghanistan who were supposed to be coming out. About 10,000 troops will remain in Afghanistan longer than previously planned. And obviously, since recent Taliban offensives in Kunduz and across the country have exposed the many weaknesses of the Afghan army and the police, that is not so much a surprise. But it is. There's something sort of tragic about the idea that America's longest war is getting longer. The president clearly doesn't want this thing to go on forever. He talked about an endless war today in the White House. How do you see this war?
Well, not just the war is getting longer, it's becoming more complicated because there is a new player that has emerged on the scene in the form of the Islamic State, ISIS. Which is not the Taliban, but is engaging in similar kinds of insurgency, and is in fact more vicious and violent than the Taliban, which means that not only that the previous insurgency has not finished, but that you have metastasizing of this extremist insurgency in Afghanistan. So I think the withdrawal of troops was premised on the notion that Afghanistan had become stable enough that we could basically hand over security to Afghan security forces. But the fall of Kunduz, the spate of suicide bombings in Kabul have basically put to question that assumption. And then I think it's prudent of the United States to maintain at least a minimal force in order to make sure that the government and the security forces don't unravel in the manner that the Iraqi security forces unraveled in Mosul when ISIS took over most of that country.
So how would you compare the threat of ISIS with the notion that Pakistan has always been somewhat perfidious in its relations with the United States? Many analysts I've spoken to, Marvin Weinbaum and Thomas Barfield and others, have indicated that of all the countries in the neighborhood, that is Iran, Russia, China, and the U.S. and NATO there in Afghanistan, they all want a stable Afghanistan. But the assumption is that Pakistan doesn't, and they're hedging or whatever they're doing. So give us a sense, your assessment of Pakistan's motives and how they compare in terms of a threat to the Islamic State.
Well, we saw Pakistan as supporting the Taliban for a very long time. That was a cause of a great deal of friction between the United States and Pakistan. Things seem to have stabilized, but the recent surge in Taliban activity has again put Pakistan's Afghanistan policy into the limelight. But the ISIS issue is not a Pakistani creation. It really speaks to the fact that the Afghan political scene and security scene is still too weak, and there is so much space that a group like ISIS can essentially set up shop and start a whole new challenge to the Afghan government. So, you know, we could negotiate or pressure Pakistan over the Taliban, but not over ISIS. And also the Pakistani role in Afghanistan has to do with the way in which Pakistan sees threat and opportunity in Afghanistan. And the American project in Afghanistan has not addressed, if you would, the Pakistani anxieties about Afghanistan. And as a result, Pakistan has changed tactic but not strategy about Afghanistan.
So how much then does Pakistan, well, there may well be divisions, as they always have been, between the civilian government and the military in Pakistan, but how much does Pakistan recognize the threat of reverse sanctuary from with their Pakistan Taliban? If they were, if the Taliban were to take over Afghanistan, wouldn't the Pakistanis be faced with a reverse sanctuary problem with the Pakistan Taliban?
Yes, they would. But there are two issues here. I think there are some people in Pakistan who think an Indian influence in Kabul or a strong Afghan government that is supported by the United States is an equal, if not a larger, threat to them than a Taliban-controlled Kabul. And secondly is that to some extent also Pakistan does not control the Taliban by remote control. So it has a great deal of control over the sanctuary the Taliban have, the control of their flow of arms and money, and it can carry out operations against them. But the Taliban are also not an entirely Pakistani puppet. They're a reality in Afghanistan with their own interests. So they do take advantage of the fact that Pakistan's interests in Afghanistan are served by their activities, and they get benefit and support from Pakistan. But this is not a Pakistani invasion force. This is an Afghan group that benefits from Pakistan's support, but it actually has its own interest in Afghanistan, and it's able to control large parts of the country exactly because the Afghan government is unable to provide security and governance to its people.
And again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who's the Dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. And between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, is there any likelihood then of any kind of change in this unfortunate America's longest war and the extent to which a so-called ally, Pakistan, has been, some people hold Pakistan responsible for the deaths of all the American soldiers. But even if that is an overstatement, they've certainly, the people who've been killing America's troops in Afghanistan receive sanctuary, if not training and arms, from Pakistan. So that's in itself a pretty peculiar situation. But there's been some speculation that since this deal with the P5 plus one in Iran, that there's a possibility of an opening with Iran. And if we were to, and Iran apparently was quite cooperative with the U.S. in the early stages of its war in Afghanistan. And of course, the Indians helped the Iranians build a road all the way up from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Herat, which would, of course, be a much less challenging and less expensive way for the U.S. to supply Afghanistan, since they have to fly stuff in and have, for the longest time, have had to transit through Pakistan, where the Pakistanis have clearly gouged U.S. and NATO. So is there any reason to have any optimism that some alternative...
Afghanistan is a complex problem, decades in the making. There's no shortcut solution to it. And Afghanistan's neighbors, live next door to Afghanistan. They have vital interests in the outcome in that country. Sometimes those interests converge with ours, sometimes it doesn't. And they also have invested heavily in realizing their goals. And they are also competing with one another, particularly Pakistan and India, over who gets the upper hand in Afghanistan and who can better influence its future, and how they want to close the door to the rival to control Afghanistan. We came with our own counterterrorism agenda there, and we failed to sort of make that the dominant narrative for all the neighbors, and we failed to... or didn't even try to find a way to bring the interests of the neighbors into alignment, either with one another or with our project. And we also failed to build a sufficiently strong Afghan state that could keep the neighbors out. So, yes, of course, the Pakistanis are culpable in large measure for the problem in Afghanistan. But pointing the finger to them does not solve the problem. The key issue is that why is Pakistan investing so much time and effort in supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan? What do they think they're going to get out of it? What are they protecting themselves from? What is the vital national interest that they're dedicated to? And ultimately, this is what is driving Pakistani policy. They were supporting the Taliban before we went in. They were supporting the Taliban when we were in there, and they were supporting the Taliban when we got out of there. And their attitude towards what they want to see happen in Afghanistan has not changed, and nor has Iran's, for that matter. And the irony, which is why our policy is sometimes not effective, is that our interests in Afghanistan were always more aligned with Iran. But we treated Pakistan as an ally in Afghanistan and Iran as an enemy. And that ultimately we had a very difficult relationship with Pakistan, because we assumed that Pakistan is a close ally. But in Afghanistan, their interest and our interest did not meet at all, whereas the interest of our major regional enemy, Iran, actually converged with ours. Even today, the Iranians not only favor stability in Afghanistan, but also Iran's clients in Afghanistan are the ones that are fighting ISIS and Taliban. But again, even despite the nuclear deal, we have no conversation with Iran over Afghanistan, and there is no sort of coordination. So the United States has found itself in this sort of a no man's land in Afghanistan, where it's relying on countries for help whose interests are not the same as ours and are supporting actually the forces we're fighting, and we're not relying on the country who can help us because we have no relations with them because of other regional and international issues.
And Vali Nasser, when you served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to Richard Holbrooke, the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan from 2009 to 2011, it's my understanding that Richard Holbrooke from the beginning wanted to be able to have a part of his portfolio the Kashmir issue. And if
you... that would have been a mistake.
Uh-huh.
And I think he very quickly realized it.
I see.
You cannot solve an insoluble problem somewhere else in the world.
Right.
Especially when the United States itself has no commitment to solving that problem.
Right. So is that to say then that is not the principal obstacle? In other words, if you could get India and Pakistan to sort of de-escalate, wouldn't that make a big difference? Because Pakistan's concern about India in Afghanistan is a combination of paranoia and reality.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, and Holbrooke wanted to get them to de-escalate in Afghanistan without trying to solve the the major Gordian knot in the relationship that goes back to the birth of the two countries. So a much smaller gain would have been to find a solution where both countries would agree to basically treat Afghanistan as neutral territory. It was almost like a Bismarckian effort to get the two countries to agree not to fight over Afghanistan and to observe certain neutrality, that Delhi would agree that they're not going to use Afghanistan as a staging ground against Pakistan, and Pakistan would agree not to use Afghanistan as a staging ground against India, and both of them would agree that you would have a neutral government in Kabul that would be no closer to Delhi than it was to Islamabad. That would have been a way to get them to agree on Afghanistan without them to get to agree on the much larger issues that sit between them. And even that would have been an extremely difficult thing to arrive at, and it would have taken a long time and a long process of engagement and diplomacy. But ultimately, he died and the administration's Afghan policy was actually not dominated by diplomatic vision that would get the regional powers to change their strategy, but was dominated by a military solution that ultimately didn't work, and we were not committed to it either. So it was the military and the counterinsurgency model that came out of Iraq that became the administration strategy, with the assumption that we could defeat the Taliban on the ground and we can bully the Pakistanis to stop supporting the Taliban. But that didn't work, and we sort of found a solution to bring sufficient stability to Afghanistan just to leave it and go home and focus on other things. But unfortunately, the Band-Aid we put on Afghanistan is coming off, and we're finding ourselves having to go back to dealing with a problem that we thought we had left in our rear view mirror.
Well, just in closing, Vali Nasser, is there any sense on your part that given Pakistan's attitude to the United States, particularly in terms of popular sentiment, Pakistan television is quite virulently anti-American, and there's a great deal of sense, and perhaps it's conspiratorial, but nevertheless, most Pakistanis think America is a source of all of their problems in spite of all the aid that the U.S. has given Pakistan. So what happens if the U.S. sort of gets out and lets China replace it? What would the loss be?
Well, first of all, we have been disengaged from Pakistan for a very long time, and some of the bitterness has to do with that. We are definitively siding with India on all issues, from a civil nuclear deal that President Bush signed to the great engagement between President Obama and First Man Mohan Singh, and now Prime Minister Modi. I mean, it's very clear that we're not really engaged with Pakistan unless there is a terrorism issue that we want them to act on, and we don't give that much aid that really actually affects Pakistanis. We give a lot of military aid to Pakistan. We give very little aid that actually goes to impact Pakistani lives. Pakistanis can show you a Chinese bridge or a Chinese road, but it's very difficult to show them a road that America has built in the last 50 years. So we are estranged from one another. But ultimately, Pakistan is a nuclear-powered country. It has a lot of nuclear weapons, and we really cannot afford to wash our hands off of it completely. But having said that, we don't have a Pakistan strategy either. We don't have a roadmap of how do you change public attitudes towards the United States in Pakistan. How do you create better relationship with the Pakistani government? There are other countries around the world where the public don't like the United States. You could take a case of Egypt, for instance. But that the governments have always been very close to the United States, and we've seen eye to eye with them. Our problem is not necessarily with the public in Pakistan. Our problem is actually with the decision makers in Pakistan.
Well, Vali Nasser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who's the Dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Israel to speak with the former Speaker of the Knesset. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Israel is Avraham Berg, who's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as the leader of the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003 and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and is the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Avraham Berg.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And is this situation where a lot of speculation is now coming out that a third intifada might be brewing? There appears to be a vacuum or a failure of leadership here on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side. Are they just sort of incapable of dealing with this situation that appears to be spiraling out of control?
Listen, everybody's looking for the date and for the exact minute in which the unrest or the political eventuality can be officially declared as the third intifada, and then what? Nobody has really a clue what is it exactly, so let's try to define it, okay? There is no doubt there is a political vacuum, leadership vacuum, but the vacuum is a bit larger, at least from the Israeli side, and I do not pretend to speak here on behalf of anything at the Palestinian side because they are quite eloquent by themselves, but Israel failed to answer itself in the last 50 years or so to three basic questions. The first is, what do we really want to do and to happen with the occupied territories? What do we want to do and to happen with the non-Jewish citizens of Jerusalem? And what do we want to do and to happen with the 20% of Israeli citizens who are from Palestinian origin? As long as we don't give answers to these basic questions, and we go for rhetorics and cliches and speeches at the UN and whatever, but no substantial answer, people and the leadership does not supply answer from top down, so people at the street try to create an answer by bottom-up action.
But isn't there an element to do with the Temple Mount or Al-Aqsa here in the sense that Abbas has just said that the Israelis are attacking our religion, and the fact that settlers are sort of pouring into the Temple Mount, isn't that causing unnecessary friction? Everybody knows, should know, that this is the third holiest site in Islam, and the last thing you want to do is stir up 1.7 billion Muslims.
Let's call an elephant, okay? There is no doubt that in the midst of Jerusalem, there is the number one holy site for the Jews, which is number two or three holy site for the Muslims. This is not a reason for conflict or what, but since we are in a conflict for so many years, the conflict has exploded. expressed through the struggle over to whom the temple Mount Haram Sharif belongs to deteriorates the conflict from a tribal to national conflict between two nations into a religious conflict. And the most significant difference between this unrest and the previous second intifada of the year 2000, which also started at the Temple Mount, that this is saturated with religious symbols and religious expressions, both by the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. And it looks as if that both leaderships are having, I would say, they are reluctant or they are incapable of restraining the eruptive religious forces within their own camp. Both the Netanyahu cannot stop his ministers and members of Knesset, and Mahmoud Abbas finds it very difficult to stop his religious activists. So, yes, there is a problem there.
So has this situation migrated then from political control into a kind of religious zeal? Because in many ways, by definition, there is a kind of irrational element to religious fervor and fundamentalism.
The religious anxiety or the religious zeal or the religious fanaticism is always here. But the question is it the number one factor or is it just a factor contained by others? I mean, as long as you have political leadership, international process, hope for the people from the bottom, and a serious process of leadership from the top, so the religious element is contained or is possible to maintain. The minute there is no process, none whatsoever, between the two sides, people at the street are lost. They listen to the leadership, both the Israelis listening to their prime minister, and they believe that we are again being victimized. The Palestinians listening to Mahmoud Abbas at the UN and believing that actually he has no way out of the limbo. So people assume or acquire responsibility into their own very hands, and the result is that the religious player is the only game in town. And that's what we see today. No political game, just religious game.
Well, the reason I'm focusing on it, Avram Berg, is that it appears to be a possible spark if this thing has not already been ignited, and that rather than pour gasoline on the flames, political leaders should be doing everything they can to, douse the fire.
A day will come in which both you and myself and our audiences will revisit these 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then we shall know, do we talk about turning point, game changers, watershed days, or is it just part of a normal day at the Middle East office, okay? We don't really know. It sounds as if the potential of it is a game changer, as if we are moving from post-Oslo to dead Oslo, which is, it's between being very sick and going for the funeral. It's not the same.
Sure.
And do we bury Oslo today, or is it just dying Oslo? Very difficult to know. We shall know it only with time. Let's hope that Secretary Kerry coming to the region and there some expressions of responsibility by both leaders might lead to the extinguish of the fire rather than for the reignition of the fire.
And again, I'm speaking with Avram Berg, who is in Israel. He's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as the leader in the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003 and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. And he is the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. What role are the security people playing in this situation? It's sort of interesting to see the inside game and the outside game, if you will, where Netanyahu took all of his top security people to Moscow and apparently made some kind of a deal with Putin before he sent his planes and troops into Syria. And it does seem that there's no question that the Israeli Defense Forces are able to protect the country from outside threats, but they've never been able to deal sensibly or effectively with the Palestinian situation. There was that movie made about all of the former heads of the security services from both Mossad and Shin Bet about the Palestinians. It was called The Gatekeepers. And the total consensus in that movie is we, the Israelis, have tactics vis-a-vis the Palestinians, but no strategy. So are we revisiting that argument as well?
The no strategy, you know, sometimes a collection of tactics is becoming a strategy. And for the last almost 5 decades, since 67, there will be those who will say even earlier, since 48, Israel really did not develop a serious approach, neither to the region, do we want to integrate, and if so, what are the prices and what are the rewards, and we did not develop a serious policy towards the Palestinian presence in our life, both in the occupied territories and within the boundaries of Israel. And this is part of the questions that I put earlier on our table, and this is what do we want to do with this population? How much can you defer it? How much can you postpone it? I mean, the temporary occupation is lost already almost a full 5 decades. There is a limit to the cynics, to the cynicism of politics at that case, and the Palestinian, and I understand them, became impatient. They want something else, something better, at least self-governing of their own life. I think that's what surprises Israel time and again, and it surprises the Israeli leadership time and again, is how persistent and how stubborn the Palestinians are about their independence. And every leader comes to power, from Menachem Begin during the 70s and the 80s, to Yitzhak Shamir, which was the master of stubbornness, to Yitzhak Rabin, to Ariel Sharon, realized by the end of the day that the day will come in which we have to address the issue. Today, these days are the days of Netanyahu to address the issue, and he cannot run away from it.
Well, but you would think, though, that the evidence is very clear when you talk about Palestinian stubbornness and wanting, where the perfect becomes the enemy of the good. What's happening in reality throughout the entire Middle East is that the levels of radicalism increase and they become more and more bloody, more and more insane, more and more vicious, more and more nihilistic. Look at the Islamic State. And now you have apparently some influence of the Islamic State within the Palestinian territory. So why would Abbas and company not recognize that unless you come up with some kind of compromise, all that happens is your population gets more and more radicalized as they get more and more frustrated?
Let's be fair. The first is, it is not just that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is getting radicalized. It is all over the place, within America as well, and within Europe as well, and in North Africa as well. So our region is not an orphan. I mean, it is part of a larger, wider international dynamic or trend that we have to pay attention to. The second element is, unfortunately, the tensions and the motivations are always there. We as Israelis, and of course we or you as outsiders, pay attention to it only when all of the sudden the toll of bodies is too high. I mean, remember ISIS. ISIS were killing each other for years, or nobody paid attention. All of the sudden, they executed maliciously a couple of Western activists and journalists, and all of the sudden, the entire West woke up. That's the level of hypocrisy. And I say the region suffers seriously, and we should pay attention to it not only when it becomes costly to us. We should pay attention to it because we have to do the right thing, not we have to do the burning thing.
But when you talk about attention, no government on this planet, as far as I can see, has been given more attention, particularly from the United States, than the government of Israel. I mean,
No. I'm sorry. First, First, my governments, I mean, since the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin that we are going to commemorate its 20th anniversary next month, no Israeli government seriously invested into solution in the West Bank, but investing into the illusion of maintaining the crisis or maintaining the conflict, which is impossible to maintain a volcano like this. The second is, one day we have to put on the table the failure of the American foreign policy to be a fair and honest broker to this conflict. And we are facing a situation in which Europe, that our conflict is knocking on its door, is a castrated giant. They have a guilt-feeling syndrome vis-a-vis colonialism and vis-a-vis the Holocaust, an inferiority complex vis-a-vis United States of America, and therefore they're totally paralyzed when it comes to deal with the Middle East. And America, that both sides of the aisle are applauding in a schmaltzy way to every cliche of the Israeli prime minister, which is fine. I mean, that's the political choice, and that's the political value, and sometimes it's even admirable. But when I'm a Palestinian and I look at something like this, I say, listen, this America cannot be an honest broker because it's one-sided. So when you have a conflict with international magnitude that neither Europeans nor the Americans are seriously serious candidates for brokering the problem, so why do you wonder?
Well, it's as if Israel is a victim of its own success in having an extraordinary amount of influence over the United States government, with Netanyahu making speeches here before the Congress. And this has become a kind of feedback loop. They're essentially all talking to themselves and not getting off the dime.
I don't disagree.
So what's it going to take to get him off the dime? But surely it's not going to take a third intifada. That's crazy.
Let's say something which is as painful as it is. There is a fair chance that this kind of unsolvable reality will continue for a couple of more years. Only did I tell you in June 67, that this unsolvable day-to-day micro nanotactic reality will continue for 48 years, you would have said, Abram, you're out of your mind. It's impossible. And here it lasted almost 5 decades, okay? So it can continue a couple of more years. I mean, by the end of the day, it's a decision first to be done by the Israeli leadership, because we are, as you rightly stated, we are the strongest element in the region, and we have the power and we have the responsibility to resolve it. And if we do not want to do it, there are two options. One is a very brutal, unpleasant international pressure. And the second is a very persistent but nicer and more responsible pressure. The one will be done by the nations who would like to see sanctions against Israel, by the civil society, which puts a lot of pressure on governments and local governments. And this might lead to a very unpleasant political situation. The second is, if the Americans will wake up by the end of the day, and the president, whomever will be the next president, maybe even still this president, and the Congress and the Senate will not accept anymore something that they do not accept any other place around the world.
Well, just in closing, Avram Berg, trying to be positive here, if it's possible. In the United States, our politics, as has happened in Israel, have moved very much to the right. The Republican Party now is an incredibly right-wing party, and it's at war with itself, with its own vestiges of its history. And as many have said recently, neither Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan could get elected as Republicans today. But on the other hand, you do have a kind of leftist revival here in the United States, where the word socialism has been a dirty word forever, but now you have a socialist running for president, and he's drawing big crowds, and he's not too far behind Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side.
It was a fantastic debate yesterday.
I agree with you. So
very qualitative, and between me and you, all of a sudden you hear new terms in American politics. Interesting.
Very interesting. So do you think that could happen too in Israel, that the left could get revived?
For this, Ian, I'm afraid we need another program. Okay.
Okay. Well, look, I'll let you go, and I thank you for joining us.
Be well.
You too.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Avram Berg, who is in Israel. He's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as a leader in the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003, and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. And he's the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into what arrangements Israel might have made with Russia at a recent meeting in Moscow between Putin and Netanyahu.
War is not the answer.
Politicians and them
bobo niggas thing. War is not the answer.
Taking
over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. We tell the politicians and them start drop them bomb. Yeah. War is not the answer. Taking over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, and he headed its Middle East unit. Asher Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity. His latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And I wanted to talk to you about this notion that a new intifada is brewing and that there seems to be a vacuum of leadership on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side as the situation appears to be spiraling out of control. But just since your specialty is the tri-state area, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, etc., what do you think went on before the Russians deployed in Syria and began their bombing and the Marines and their intelligence, military intelligence people, the GRU, sent their units in there? Prime Minister Netanyahu and a delegation of senior national security, Israeli national security officials went to Moscow. And it's as though a deal was made that the Russians weren't going to go in there with their military unless they had some kind of an arrangement with the Israelis. So, because there's a history where Israel has, in wars with Syria, has killed a number of Russians, and even three generals apparently were killed.
Yes, I mean, it's very clear that there was a need for some kind of military coordination between Israel and Russia. Both Israel and Russia now are operating above Syria, their air forces, and there was no question that from Israel's perspective that there was a need to make some coordination of sorts, perhaps drawing certain red lines of where one air force is able to operate as opposed to the other, and that was necessary for Israel, and that clearly has been done.
But no such arrangement has been made with the United States. Apparently, Putin has been calling for the U.S. to cooperate and hand over coordinates for Russian targeting, but Putin apparently wants the coordinates of the U.S.-backed rebels, so the U.S. is not handing them over because he basically wants to kill their guys and not necessarily go after the Islamic State.
I think there is already military coordination between Israel and the United States. That, you know, there is a long history of cooperation. That is what we have been seeing with Russia. That is new because Russia has now entered the game in full force. And to the best of my understanding, also Russia is flying closer to Israel than the Allied forces led by the United States are. The Allied forces are mostly focused on the northeast part of Syria, And it looks like Russia is going much closer to physically and geostrategically to Israel. And I think that behind that was the very important meeting between the two parties.
So what do you think is going on here in the broader strategic sense? Do the Israelis agree with Putin and the Russians that Assad has to be supported?
I think that implicitly it is in Israel's interest that there is some form of equilibrium in the civil war. And if that means also propping up Assad in Damascus, then so be it. It was, when the civil war started, the Syrian civil war started, there were Israeli officials that were speaking about wishing good luck to both all parties. And it's in Israel's interest right now that the equilibrium between the two parties is stayed, between the rival forces and the regime, stays as it is and doesn't tilt too much in favor of one side or the other. And of course, you have to take into account Hezbollah that plays a major role now in the Syrian arena, and that would have is already having a dramatic effect on Israeli security and strategic concerns. And we don't know what went on in the conversation, obviously, between Putin and Netanyahu. But I'm sure that behind Israel's motives is some concern about Hezbollah's accumulative experience in Syria and the need to have some form of control as much as possible of Hezbollah's operations in that country.
But clearly that it's not just Russia that's putting boots on the ground and flying lots of bombing runs. Iran's just sent in Revolutionary Guard units, and Hezbollah apparently have also increased their deployments, and they're basically all along the Syria-Lebanon border. So one would think that the Israelis wouldn't be too happy about the idea that Iran is actively involved right next door.
Yeah, no question about that. And at the same time, we have to take into account that Israel's ability to actually influence what has been going on in Syria is very limited. There is very little Israel could do to move things forward in its towards what might be of Israel's interest. And it seems to me that the minimal thing that Israel was able to do was to reach some kind of cooperation with the Russians. That was something attainable, that was something tangible, and that was clearly achieved, or it seems to be that it may have been achieved. And the deep involvement of Iran now in the Syrian civil war, including Hezbollah, that is something that Israel has very little control of, if not, maybe even no control of. And like so many other regional players, it's so messy in the Syria now that Israel can, I think, stay back as much as possible and let matters unfold unless they are really threatening Israel's immediate security concerns.
Well, let's turn to threats to Israel's immediate security concerns, and that, of course, is the possibility of a third intifada, which many think is already starting to erupt. I'm astounded that this has in many ways been provoked by restrictions to Palestinians entering Al-Aqsa. Why would you want to do that? I mean, everybody knows that the Al-Aqsa is the third holiest shrine in Islam, and the Arabs and Muslims are extremely sensitive about it. So is that what's provoked this? That's what Abbas is saying. Abbas is saying this is about attacking our religion.
I think this is an important a part of one important reasons for the recent surge in Palestinian violence, but I would also put it in a broader context of continued occupation. I also think it is not coincidental that many of the Palestinian attackers actually came from East Jerusalem. Seemingly, East Jerusalemite, Palestinian East Jerusalemite have, you know, better access to Israel, and their living standards are supposedly higher than their brothers in the West Bank, definitely higher than in Gaza. But the fact that the violence is coming mostly from East Jerusalemites is really interesting and intriguing, and it tells us something about very deep elements, roots that have been going on within the area of East Jerusalem. First, there is no access. Palestinian leadership cannot access them. So you can see these, lone people attacking without really leadership infrastructure, without any movement behind them that would claim responsibility. And so that's a very important part of it. Of course, for East Jerusalemites, they, unlike other Palestinians in the West Bank or Gaza, they see the Haram Sharif, they see the Noble Sanctuary, the Temple Mount, and they are the ones that are losing the most, I mean, tangible loss from the inability to access the Temple Mount, and from they are the ones, I think, that are also most exposed to lots of conspiracy theories about what Israel is or not doing in that area. And you have to add to that, of course, Israel's own actions. And even here, I would think of the government, which is clearly now led by, I would say that this is the most right-wing government that we have ever had in Israel. And so that's on the one hand, one side, actual Israeli politicians that are advocating more Israeli, more Jewish presence on the Temple Mount, and also from the settler movement, from the fringes of the settler movement, that have been now advocating for that and have been leading a non-governmental campaign to allow more and more access to that area, to the Pet Temple Mount. I mean, what was a rabbinical prohibition to go up the Temple Mount until 10, 15 years ago has been completely eroded. And now you see hundreds and sometimes thousands of Israelis, or Jewish Israelis, going up the Temple Mount out of their own religious motivation. So all of that adds to the growing sense of frustration that has been going on. And the end result is this new surge of violence. Can we call it a third intifada? I would wait and see if how it unfolds. It could calm down. It may not. I really don't know. But we have been waiting for, you know, another wave of violence, because everybody with, you know, with some some sober ability to analysis, to analyze what is happening in Israel, Palestine, knows that the status quo is not. It's not sustainable. It just cannot last like this for long. And so what we are seeing now is this new wave of violence, and we'll see how it unfolds.
Well, but surely at the heart of this is this idea that there's been a Israeli-Palestinian peace process, which looks more and more like a complete fraud. I mean, there was a while back that the so-called Palestinian papers were leaked to Al Jazeera, that obviously from angry Palestinians, angry at their own government, who they feel have been taken for a ride, that all of these negotiations have yielded nothing and the suffering of the Palestinians have increased while more and more of the West Bank is annexed by the settler movement. I mean, that seems to be objectively the reality, isn't it? That the peace process has been about a process but not about peace. And nobody knows, and I would love it if you could tell me what it is that the Jewish, you say this is the most right-wing Jewish government or the most right-wing Israeli government in history. What is their end game for the Israeli right? What do they, at the end of the day, do they want to do with the Palestinians?
I think you ask the million-dollar question that very few people have answered to, because even this government doesn't fully say, okay, what is our strategic plan? What are our strategic goals? Netanyahu has never said that. I mean, from his coalition, Naftali Bennett has said that he would like to annex Area C, the area in the West Bank that is in full control, under full control of Israel. But even that is not, you know, far-sighted strategic thinking. And right now in Israel, you don't really see any strategic thinking, because you would think that this right-wing government would say, okay, we believe that this area is belongs to the Jewish people, and therefore we simply annex it, or we do something with it. But what has been happening is the opposite. It's this crawling policy of more settlers, more settlements, but not a decisive move, or not even a very clear vision of, you know, how would Israel look like 10, 20 years from now. You don't see that. You do see it from the margins or the small groups within the settler movement. They clearly have a strategy. And I think one of their goals is indeed provoking violence, because they see the Palestinian violence as something that works in their own advantage. It radicalized Israel, it radicalized the Jewish community, in Jewish majority in Israel, and it promotes further militarization in the West Bank. It promotes more military involvement, and that all is all in their favor as they see it. So I think what you find is strategic thinking and strategic actions from certain elements of the settler movement who are really thinking about the future from their perspective and are promoting an atmosphere, public opinion, that is all in all in their favor, and in favor of their vision of taking over the West Bank and simply making it, completely integrating it into Israel. I don't think that you find from many of them, you won't find, you know, strategic thinking about, okay, so what do you do with the Palestinian population there? There are some on the margins of the Palestinian, of the settler movement, some who speak about expulsion, but the leadership of the settler movement doesn't really speak in these terms. But it does lead into, it does lead Israel and Israeli society into this notion of, there's nobody to speak with. Palestinians are, as a community, are violent, and therefore the only response to their violence is our supposedly defense, violent defense, and so on.
Right, but it's taking territory is an offensive action, not a defensive action.
Yes, for maybe you and me, but there are enough Israeli Jews out there that are genuinely thinking about the West Bank as you know, the beating heart of the Holy Land. You know, when we read the Bible, Abraham was walking in, you know, was herding his sheep next to Hebron and not next to Tel Aviv. So for so many Israeli religious Jews, it is there where, I mean, this is the heart of the promised land.
I see. Well, I guess every time you have Haagen-Dazs ice cream, you're supporting the confiscation of Palestinian land and home. So,
yes.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Asher Kaufman. I appreciate your perspective.
Welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, and he headed its Middle East unit. Asher Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.